Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, and today I'm quite excited. I'm thinking we're going to be talking a lot, and I think we're going to be talking about exciting topics like sort of the relationship perhaps between entrepreneurship and business and the development sector. I also think we'll be talking about the transition, the transformation, and what it is like to be active at some of the higher levels in the development sector and distributing aid and help in conflict zones and things like that. And also the younger generation. I think we'll be talking a lot about the younger generation, how to get them on board, or how, you know, we're maybe behind them or something like that. Very, very welcome to the podcast, Josefine Sundqvist.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure and honor to be here.
I do this semi-lazy, semi open thing about letting you define yourself. So I'm going to ask you the same question that I ask everyone that comes on the podcast. Who are you, Josefine Sundqvist?
So I would describe myself as a transformational leader. What really makes me going is to drive change, not to get stuck in status quo, or to be too nostalgic about the history, but actually to see that the future is ahead of us. And we are well positioned to actually drive positive change. So the future is not yet defined. And that is something that excites me. Also, on a private note, I'm a mother. And I have two kids, and it's really fascinating and inspiring to see how different the young generation is today from when I was young, even though I'm at this point only 41. But still, it's a huge difference. My kids are connected a lot globally through gaming. My kids are very globalized in mindset. There is not necessarily the Swedish news that will be of most interest. Could be as well BBC News or Al Jazeera. So even though they are of Swedish citizenship, they are more globalized in mindset. And that is really fascinating to witness. At the same time, what I would also say defines me is I'm very much active person, socially engaged person. I have done many personality tests in recruitments, and I always score high on the extrovert side. For those who knows Myers-Briggs, I'm ENTP. Profile, if you want to put me in a box. But yes, I'm extrovert, I'm talkative. I would like to see myself as visionary. I like to drive change that is not just yet realized. So I actually like to envision things that we cannot yet see materialized. But if we dare to be creative and brave and bold, we can actually go beyond what's in the square. So I'm not a super squared person, but I guess I'm a bit more on the creative spectrum. I love music. I love to play piano and guitar at home, even if I'm not a professionalized musician such as yourself. But I feel music can open up other worlds where you can envision transformation in unique ways. Finally, I'm also a person of faith. I see faith and spirituality as a tool for transformation, as an enabling force to help us to be bold, to go beyond what's imaginable. So for me, faith is also inspiration. It also gives me comfort, and it helps me to build compassion for people and the planet.
Wow. Just inviting your professional role and your professional journey, like what is it that you do now, and how did you get there?
I think that's a really relevant and brilliant question. I actually like to start, as you noticed, not from my LinkedIn merits and titles. And it's because I often like to show the difference between leadership and management. Mm. We all have our formal titles, but what is quite important, I think, is to not lose yourself within the framework of your formal titles. But if we go at the more formal level, I'm the Secretary General, the CEO of LM International. Our Swedish brand is Läkarmissionen, and we are a Swedish global foundation. We work with humanitarian interventions, development cooperation, and peace building in about 25 countries around the globe. I have been leading our foundation for the last 3 years. And prior to that, I was working for Swedish government, SIDA agency, Swedish International Development Cooperation Agency. I've also have been in research. I was working 7 years for Uppsala University in an interdisciplinary program on religion and globalization and human rights. And my PhD is within the field of theology and human rights. And my master degree is within global political economy. And my bachelor degree in development and peace studies. So I'm a system thinker. I've also worked with humanitarian aid in the field. I've been based 12 years in Eastern Africa. And I've seen really the field reality, which is relatively different from when you sit and work with policy with SIDA in Stockholm. I'm also an entrepreneur. So my first job was actually to run a coffee shop in Jönköping, a small city in not a small one. It's actually Sweden's 9th or 10th biggest city now. So, but it is a small city if I compare to places like Dar es Salaam, Nairobi, Cape Town, many, many of these places I often end up in. Yeah.
Great. So, when we were connected by a mutual acquaintance, and one of the, I'd like to start kind of where I was thinking we were going to talk about. And then there was so much else that opened up when we had a pre-call. But what I'm really curious about at the moment is, I mean, there's this thing that's happening in the world where it seems like governments or the public sector is maybe wobbling a little bit. I mean, there's a lot of things that are going on in the political sphere and things that are going on in the sort of economic sphere that makes maybe the public space a little bit less reliable than it used to be. And there's a story now that, oh, now is the time for the business world to step in. And now the business world should do good things. And you see these sort of very wealthy, usually men, that are doing philanthropy or doing these things. And then they come in with a completely different operating logic, I think, than what is normally present in development sector. And I'm really trying to learn and understand a bit more about what's going on there and what are the, let's say, the benefits of the development sector and the history and the institutional weight of that. Like, what's the wisdom of that? And what are the things where we should maybe innovate or think differently or where we need to challenge the status quo, as you were saying. And so, but doing that intelligently, because I think there's also like an, yeah, so that's kind of the framing that I initially thought that we would going to come into this with, and I was going to just stick to that plan. And so I'm curious about, from your perspective of being in development space, and I mean, you're also doing, LM is doing also responsive stuff, like when there's actually crisis, and you're actually sort of, you could be the first on the ground or have people present that you deploy and so forth. So that's also a different area. But in, how would you frame the state of the state of action, or like what do you see as a generative way of approaching the situation that the world is in, both in terms of crises in a immediate sense, emergency sense, and crisis in a more sort of longer directional developmental sense of like environmental crises and all these things that are unfolding? How does it look like from your perspective, and what's it?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I wanna raise is really that we have a global agenda uniting us all, and that's the 2030 agenda. And it's built up on 17 goals, and goal number 17 relates to partnerships for global development. And if we look at today's crisis, I mean, we have just been through the pandemic. We have the, of course, very present consequences of climate change, loss of biodiversity and ecosystem services. But we are also in a state of crisis when it comes to increased conflicts and wars. And looking at this, the funding we have for humanitarian responses and development is not enough. It's not a match if you look at the needs and the existing funds. So we have a gap, and there's been a number of initiatives of global conferences trying to increase OECD DAC, the donor countries, to increase their finance ambitions. But the reality is that actually countries in Europe are rather dropping. Even in Sweden, we have seen that we are not anymore funding 1% of our GDP to development cooperation and humanitarian aid. So rather than increasing the resource base of taxation from the West, we see a fall, a decrease. And it's also a reality that even if all the countries in the West would pay 1%, it still wouldn't be enough if we look at the existing calculations. So we need to really unleash new capital to respond to ongoing crises and emergencies. And it's here the private sector comes in as an enabling force. If we can work together in smarter ways for a larger transformational vision and for the 2030 agenda, we actually have the capital needed. If you look how much profit that is generated daily only in Sweden, and if you look at, for example, the wealthiest 10%, if we could really look at that capital as an enabling factor and see how can Swedish investors and Swedish entrepreneurs become key players for global transformation, then we can really see change happening at the larger scale. So I would say where we are at now, we need to break silos between civil society, the nonprofit sector, the public sector, the private sector, and academia. We need to start working together. We must also realize that we are interconnected. And this is really what I value when it comes to World of Wisdom and this podcast, is really to see that we are all interconnected. If we are one big organism, and if one is hurt, we will eventually be hurt. We are all connected, and this we got to see through the pandemic, that actually vulnerability somewhere else created vulnerabilities for us, even in a wealthy nation like Sweden. So we are interconnected, and we need to really break silos between sectors. We also need to change our views on entrepreneurs. In my view, entrepreneurs are enablers. But it's not for granted that entrepreneurs will work for a good cause. entrepreneurs can work for any type of course. So it's our job in development cooperation and aid, and it's our job in LM to attract entrepreneurs, to tap into our greater vision, to utilize their creative thinking, business ideas, and the capital they generate, to really see that they should tune in to something greater and not, you know, spend their profit or time on a limited materialistic goal. So entrepreneurship in itself is, of course, positive, but the outcome of entrepreneurship will depend on which vision that drives the entrepreneur. And that's where we come in as LM. We try to really push entrepreneurs to live their lives for something greater.
One of those things that I'm worried about sometimes when we talk, when business people or people that have been in business for a long time enter into the world of aid or humanitarian, trying to do good, like the industry of trying to do good, trying to help someone, then there is a projection in me, or I've seen examples. I mean, it's more than a projection, but where people go in and they see a problem and then you fix the problem. So like this idea of effective altruism, and like the best money that you can spend is to give people mosquito nets, or we need to build wells here. And there's this sort of lack of understanding of the depth of the knowledge of the development sector in terms of working with local partners, these methods, like those things that I think a lot of business people think about as inefficiencies of the development sector. And so I was wondering if you wanted to kind of lead us into, because you're talking about the collaboration and that you would, you know, do things together, and like there would be a mutual learning between these two different sectors. I'm hearing all of those themes, which is very different than kind of setting up your own NGO and funding it after the best business practices and building the app, which might be So
why the business sector should consider engaging in partnerships with nonprofit sector and not just to start your own engagements is because it's all about how deep you want to scale, how deep you want to go with your roots. Often it takes decades to build trust with local communities. If you look into the whole school of adaptive management, to understand, if I exemplify with a country like Uganda, you have on one hand the most diverse country in the world. If you look at tribes, ethnic groups, languages, faith groups, etc. In the western part, you have Congolese refugees that have entered into Uganda. In the north of Uganda, you have South Sudanese refugees in refugee settlements. So in one way, Uganda is a humanitarian context when we talk in sort of aid language. And there you have certain frameworks that are guiding, like international humanitarian law, humanitarian core principles, humanitarian core standards, CHS. You have the cluster system with coordination on those who works on protection, health, education. You have the SWEAR standards. So when you want to set up education in emergencies in the refugee camps in northern Uganda, you need to do this according to certain standards, which is for all refugee camps across the globe. At the same time, you have development cooperation in Uganda. You have Ugandan farmers trying to improve value chain, how to get into local market expansion. You have work on gender equality, human rights in Uganda. This is work to empower Ugandan people and the rising middle class. At the same time, you also have, as I exemplified before, of course, investors and companies in Uganda, seeing Uganda as an emerging market with consumers. And if you come into this emerging market and you do not collaborate with civil society, community actors, and nonprofit sector, you might go wrong because you might not understand the, first of all, the dynamics when it comes to the nexus, development, humanitarian, and peace building. So you might not understand that in one part of the country, the conflict sensitiveness is lower and higher in other parts. And language could be a huge trigger in the conflict. Because if you look back in the history with Lord Resistance Army and the forces in Uganda, Swahili has been spoken by the fighting troops in the northern Uganda. And Swahili is also spoken by refugees coming from DRC that are non-Ugandans. So the political elite in Kampala might find a language like Swahili very politicized. And if you come in as a company and you need to know how to program our software, which languages should we use for Ugandan context? You cannot just look at the number of consumers that speaks a certain language. You have to understand that language can trigger the conflict. So even when just selecting the languages in a software product, you might actually do harm in the context of Uganda. So there's, for so many reasons, you need community actors, civil society. It's not only navigating culture, religion, norms, language. It also for understanding the consumers. We all know that if you want to succeed in market expansion, you need to co-create with those who will actually utilize your innovation or your products. And for real co-creation to happen with the consumers, with right holders, with people in the context, you need entry points to the field. And in many cases, you might need to build trust or to have those gatekeepers. So civil society can sometimes also be the gatekeepers. And this is the role we have also played in many cases. Sometimes also civil society can be social innovators. So by knowing the consumers, right holders, the people, and working with them in co-creation, civil society can sometimes aggregate and see how we best can transfer learnings between different target groups, communities, what is scalable in terms of business and what needs investment and what may not be scalable because it's simply contextual and it works in one part of the country but not in another one. So in order to navigate complexities, to get closer to the target group and consumers in co-creation, but also to make sure as a company that you do not do harm in a conflict, you really need this enabling partnerships. And we also work in LM with business and human rights. It's also important as investor and company to see that you respect human rights, you respect the nature, and you actually contribute to restoring the nature and biodiversity. So also for business and human rights dimensions, civil society plays a very, very crucial role.
Cool. So from your perspective, like, what is a generative way of starting these types of collaborations? What is the sort of, do you have either an example of a best practice or like a really good example that you felt was good? Like what, how did that come about? Or just sort of on an idea level, what would be the...
Yeah, I like to be concrete because even though I'm a system thinker and I like to look at larger transformations, I'm also an entrepreneur myself. So I like always to exemplify with concrete change in the context. Mm. So when it comes to education, we have seen in LM that all children do not have access to school buildings, school facilities, teachers. There's not simply enough facilities and teachers to match the educational needs. And sometimes the reason is just lack of school services. Sometimes the reason is that children have disabilities, so they cannot move physically to a school building or it could be mental or intellectual disability where they are not welcome into the school system, or it could also be teenage pregnancy that hinders girls from attending schools. And there can also be, as I said initially, just lack of services. And in this case, digital education can be a way to bridge these gaps and needs in education. And we have tried in all our areas of work on livelihood, health, education, and water to utilize tech and digital solutions. And when it comes to education, we are working with a Swedish innovative company called Beyond Intent. And they have a product called Binogi. They currently run about 60% of all digital educational services in Swedish municipalities. And their product is AI-driven. So if you have a curriculum for an African country and a preferred language, you can actually apply this innovation and this product into a new educational system. So this is a Postcode-funded project with Postcode Lottery. So we are working with this Swedish company to roll out this innovation in Somalia and in Tanzania. And in Somalia, we have realized we don't have actual rooms. So we have built containers that are solar-driven, and we get electricity and all needed from solar energy. So this is an example of how we are working with a Swedish company to solve a problem together. And it's really like a mutual partnership. We couldn't be as effective without this product or innovation. But at the same time, Beyond Intent, it would be very hard for them to navigate Somalia and Tanzania without their partnership with us. So it's really like a win-win example of how these kind of partnerships can work.
I know when we, when I'm jumping a little bit now, but one of the things that you were, that we were, that came up in our pre-call was this, the work that you're currently doing with the war in Ukraine, and working with some of the some African leaders on how to deal with sort of sexual and you know, violence directed towards women or vulnerable groups, and I'm curious also in terms of this what you're saying in very gentle language. I think that you are providing the context and the feet on the ground and the understanding or and the historical understanding and the humanitarian understanding and like these other aspects that might be lacking from business, not from all of businesses, but usually. I'm just curious about sort of weaving in that perspective as well, the geographical or like sort of, I mean, maybe even to be blunt about it, sort of the racism and the colonial undertones of you know, Westerners or Northern Europeans knowing and these African people not knowing and how those dynamics also play into this soup.
No, but it's really true. I mean, in development cooperation, you have really the principles of ownership, local ownership, that anything you do should originate from local leadership, may it be elected political leaders or moral duty bearers like religious, cultural leaders or local actors, businesses. So there's really this respect for local forces to own their own development in their own right. And this can sometimes be overrided when you have global investors and actors coming in and just, you know, perceiving themselves as always sit in the front, in the driving seat.
Yeah.
So I think here there is so much to do together, to look at really how to create sustainability in the local context and to build local capacity. And here the private sector can also often contribute in terms of building local capacity with local institutions, governments, local companies, businesses, also in job creation, in that way enabling a local economy to thrive that is not aid dependent. But when it comes to the example on Ukraine, we have seen, as I said, that some things are actually scalable. And one of the things we've seen is scalable is experience in civil society in Africa when it comes to rape as a weapon and survivors of sexual violence, how they actually need, as much as they need surgery and medical support, they also need psychosocial support, legal, juridical support, and also access to land and capital to feel fully empowered and to heal after experience sexual violence. And together with the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Denis Mukwege, we have worked since the start in Eastern Congo to develop together with the local population, actually, of the DRC, the right holders, to develop this modality for how to work with survivors of sexual violence. How can they break the silence to speak out? How can they also get the holistic care, personalized holistic care that they deserve? And what we have done in Ukraine is to really export this learning and this holistic care model from DRC to Ukraine. And in Ukraine, there is a local organization called SEMA Ukraine. And what I love about this is that they have picked the Swahili name. Mm. So Swahili is one of my languages that I speak fluently. And SEMA means to speak out in Swahili. So it's really beautiful to see how local civil society can connect. So this group of survivors of sexual violence, these women in Ukraine, have honored the work of women in Congo and the fact that they have broken the silence and the stigma. And they have honored them by adhering to these global networks. So SEMA Ukraine really consists of women in Ukraine that are change makers, and they are learning from DRC. We have also had Mukwege, as I said, as Nobel Peace Prize winner. He has been in Ukraine previously to also look at investigation of sexual violence as a crime. And this is a very strong signal that he has sent, is basically to show that it's non-acceptable in Ukraine in the same way as it has not been acceptable in DRC. So his solidarity is not only with the Congolese women, but it is a compassion for women at large. And this is what I also find very powerful with the Nobel Peace Prize, that you can actually use the prize as a way to transfer peace-building practices from some context on the globe to others.
I noticed two things in what you were speaking to now. I mean, one thing is this word empowerment comes back. And I think, you know, maybe just stay with that word for a little bit if you want to expand on it, because I think it's a word that we use a lot, but I also understand that it maybe means something more specific in your, through your lens than it would in sort of the general use of the word empowerment.
For us, empowerment is very central to our vision and mission and everything we do in LM. And it has been with us since the start. We started as a foundation in 1958. And our vision is dignified life, sustainable world. And the mission statement for LM as a foundation is to save life and empower people. So it's even the core of our full mission statement, why we exist and what we do. And why is empowerment so important? It's because it's always start with you and what happens on the inside. And if we are not enabling people to grow strong on the inside, it will be short-term intervention. And we see this too often in humanitarian aid. Agencies that go in and out to provide non-food items, shelter, protection. But we have to really build capacity on the inside. And growing strong on the inside means what is really so well formulated in the inner development goals. It's about developing cognitive skills. It's about believing in your own capacity, your transformational capacity. It's about creating hope for many internally displaced people. If you are lacking hope, you don't even have the capacity to wake up in the morning and continue fighting. So there are lots of inner abilities that you need to develop, especially when you face disaster and crisis. And working from empowerment means that people should own their journey, life journey. They should own their future, their development, their decision making. And what we can do as LM is to really work towards empowerment, but we can also create enabling factors, enabling environments, so that when people feel and when people are empowered, we can also lower thresholds, we can open doors, we can also push policies and laws so that refugees and IDPs can really take the lead. And in our global strategy in LM, we have three pillars. It is to mobilize, which means scaling up. It is to innovate, which means scaling wide. And then it is to transform. And that's where we are scaling deep. And in our third pillar in our strategy, where we transform, is where we are actually building local leadership, empowering local leadership in humanitarian crisis. And that is what makes us not totally unique, but I've not come across so many that are explicitly talking about building local leadership in humanitarian crisis. Many are talking about effective humanitarian response, logistic planning, effecting humanitarian fundraising. But to actually say that we're going to put our emphasis on empowerment and to build local leadership, it is something that I'm very proud of. And I'm very proud of our local leaders, because the country directors of LM, they often come from the country where they are placed. So one of our local managers and leaders that I'm really sort of inspired by, her name is Sally. She's a Sudanese woman. She is heading our programs in Sudan, which is our biggest country when it comes to country programming. And she really has this way of working where she's both a role model for other women and other local actors. But she's really showing the way. But in everything she does, she wants to enable people. She wants to build leaders. So she doesn't want to put the focus on her or LM's brand, but she tries to really see how every conversation matters. Every talk that she has with someone could make the difference. And on the border of Chad and Sudan, there is currently an enormous influx of refugees from Sudan into Chad. And we have had the possibility and privilege to really respond in this crisis because we have a long background of working in this region and on these cross-border responses. And in these refugee camps, we also see that when it comes to water governance and integrated resource water management, it's easy. And it's easy, you know, for us to think, let us just get the water points in place and get it done with high quality so that UNHCR refunds us and then we all, you know, applaud ourselves and leave. But we have said, no, let us actually, when we do the actual drilling of water, let us build local capacity. Let us look at the baselines for groundwater fetching. Let us look how we are actually letting the community stand with us, with and at the drilling machines. So whenever we leave, there is a water committee. There are people at the water point that will feel ownership of this water and of the process of actually getting the water point in place. So I think really this is the future, regardless if you're a business or a nonprofit, is really to see how in everything you do, leadership must be part of the program.
Yeah, I love that. That's such a concrete example where you could say, oh, it's so inefficient. You're taking all this time to mobilize and to build these local organizations and to do the water committee and all of that stuff. And then it's just a waste of money, you know, when you could have just gone in and drilled and been done with it. But then what you're pointing to is that the efficiency might be on a different time scale or relating to a different sort of underlying purpose, if you will. And that was the other word that I wanted to kind of lift in that was implicit in a lot of what you said is like this, you spoke about it very early on, but like this idea of something bigger than us, something beyond what we're doing, something beyond the materialistic being the reason for why we get up in the morning and why we drive the change or like why we engage in these activities that we do. Also with maybe, from my side at least, it's a little bit of a challenge towards the business community sometimes. That seems to be, you know, sometimes some people get stuck in or quite a few people get stuck in sort of monetary rewards being the end point of what they're doing. Whereas, you know, what if that's just a means to a different end? So I'm curious to weave in the spiritual now, if you will.
Yeah. No, I love that. I love to talk about spirituality and faith. When I decided to go for a PhD in theology, some of my colleagues and professional networks were a little bit shocked. Is this really a strategic move, Josephine?
Yeah.
Are you going to be that sort of introspect, not just going for humanities, but even within the field or the domain of humanities, not taking philosophy or something else, but actually theology? And to me, it's all about seeing the connection between mind, spirit, and intellect. Mm. You can reach to a certain level with your intellect in system thinking, system analysis, contextual studying. But then there is, in my view, a deeper connection that you can make to yourself, to the world, but also to a God. In my case, I believe in a personal God, but others might think of spirituality or the outside world. But to me, that gives me a very strong sort of meaning in life. It gives me very deep comfort. And also it has affected my braveness. Sometimes when I travel, even when I travel alone in countries like Somalia and Sudan and South Sudan, DRC, anything can happen to me. I've personally been experiencing people holding knives and guns at my head, etc. But I think there is something about my faith that makes me calm. I feel that I have a deeper purpose and meaning in life. What I do is not random. It is meaningful. And my faith and my conviction in my faith, it helps me to navigate when my intellectual resources is not enough. Even also when I enter into tensions, conflict, and personal interference, I often draw actually on my spiritual capacity to read people, to feel with people. And I often say that compassion. I mean, in my life, it can be different from others, and you can definitely draw compassion from secular human rights thinking. But in my view, compassion, and in my life, compassion really originates from my faith. I also feel loved. And I think in a lot of leadership advancement, I attended many CEO programs in development, cooperation, and humanitarian aid. And sometimes you see many leaders feel insecure. And that has negative effects on how they actually lead organizations and people, how they manage people. And I think if we are to resonate and to be healthy leaders, we need to have this spiritual depth in our lives where we connect with our inner self, our driving forces, our longings, our traumas. And for me, spirituality is this resource that helps me to be a whole person. It helps me to navigate people and complexities, and it gives me meaning and hope for the future. I'm very optimistic about where we are going in the world. And I think faith is one of my driving forces and reasons for feeling this hope. So I believe there is also a young generation today that really feel that spirituality and faith is an attractive resource. And I think Swedish young change agents in Sweden today, they are not as secular as my generation, because they have grown up in a much sort of undefined space that is neither religious nor secular. It's all about exploring yourself and your inner life. And in that kind of open discourse of exploring yourself, spirituality is one dimension. And I meet many young people that ask me a lot about my faith and spirituality, even if I'm not addressing it. They tell me there is something in your leadership which looks to be deeper. Can you please elaborate on that? So I often get these kind of questions from trainees in our foundation that are younger.
And just so I understand, but when you say that they're less secular, because I mean, we also see sort of an exodus, that's maybe not proper use of language, but anyways, there is a lot of people sort of, you know, not that they choose not to participate, let's say, in the Swedish church or not to participate in formalized religion and so forth. And yet you're saying that they're less secular. I'm curious about that distinction.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's all about your view on faith and religion. So you have kind of like institutionalized religion, belonging to a church, attending Sunday services or getting baptized or, you know, going through confirmation when you're 15, getting, you know, married in the church, etc. Now I'm giving examples from Christianity. Could be other rituals if we would speak about another religion. But this is one way of talking about religion and religious practices, and that is often defined in sociology of religion as institutionalized religion. But then you have faith and spirituality, which is more about looking at what is comprehensive, what is the materialistic reality, and what is beyond that, and what are explorative and what is predefined. And there you border philosophy and theology, of course. So what is tangible, what is real, what is imagined? And I would say for non-institutional religion, when we talk faith and spirituality, I think when it comes to that, I think what I see from the young generation today across the globe is a longing to be more tuned in to spirituality and to something bigger. But institutionalized religion may not be so attractive. So the question is, how will the faith and religious landscape look like in 10, 20 years to come? A lot is changing. Before, the biggest, you know, Catholic countries used to be, people would think about the Vatican State and Italy and Spain. Today we see countries like Philippines, like Brazil, when it comes to Catholic Church, when it comes to Pentecostalism, people mm-hmm. would imagine, you know, maybe US, maybe Scandinavian countries, etc. But today we see a lot of Pentecostals in countries like Nigeria. When it comes to Islam, it's easy to think that it's mainly these predefined countries in the Middle East. But actually the biggest Muslim country is Indonesia. So I think there is also a lot of lack on religious knowledge when we do our system analysis. Where are we going in terms of theology and adherence and religious practices? And a lot of things are happening. And I love to follow these trends. I often attend religious ceremonies when I travel around the globe. I think it gives me often a much deeper understanding of the context. Mm-hmm. If you only go to a hotel or a conference or a political meeting, you get to meet part of the elite. But if you actually attend a local faith service somewhere in the world, then you are digging a bit deeper. And when I was in Indonesia, 22, so this was about 1 year and 3 months ago, I was following these holy water practices, where actually the monks facilitate for the citizens on Bali to go through different water streams and waterfalls. And some of the waterfalls can give them happiness, healing of trauma, hope for the future. And they walk through the water and they stop at the water stream where they identify a certain need in their life. And then there will be a monk pouring water over their head. A bit similar to baptism in Christianity. And I mean, I've been in many religious rituals, in many world religions. And I think it's so much richness. It is a longing to actually also reveal truths about yourself, to show vulnerability. And this is what sometimes is missing in the private sector, in the business, where you don't show that vulnerability. You want to show success and you want your curves to go up. But in the faith sector, it's all about weakness, vulnerability. And then you realize if you humble yourself is where you can actually grow. You can go grow big from showing yourself as small. And I think most of the richness in my leadership, I learned from faith. And I mean, looking at holy texts, I've read the Quran, I've read the Bible, I've read a lot of holy texts. But of course, since Christianity is my personal faith, the Bible is the biggest source for me. But I actually read the Bible every day. And I know it's quite unusual to hear Swedish people say this today, but it is true. And I think it makes me a better leader.
It's, and then also, I mean, in where I'm coming from, a lot of one of the ideas that are is around is that what we need to do is to really upgrade people's worldviews. Like we need also to have sort of epistemological and ontological shifts in sort of how we relate to the world. And of course, it feels like a lost opportunity to not look at people's spirituality and like sort of those beliefs, because that's, you know, apart from the culture and sort of the things that we can observe, that's probably where a lot of that resides. I know we're kind of coming up on time, but there's one thing that I wanted to just loop back to, that, because you said something before around when we were speaking about Ukraine and the sexual sort of violence and so forth, and then one of the most important things were around breaking the silence. And I was speaking to an associate professor at KTH just recently, and she was saying that one of the most important things that she thinks a lot about right now is how can we actually break the silence in terms of our lifestyles and how we are influencing the world, and so forth. And so there's a really sort of interesting line there. And then I'm also thinking about these examples that we saw during COVID, where you would have, you know, initially during the pandemic, you would have wealthy communities giving money to poor communities and supporting them. But then at some point that interaction sort of switched, and the poor communities were teaching the wealthy communities how to grow food, or like how to set up your, you know, balcony garden or like the small scale sort of, so that you could have sort of self-sufficiency and so forth. So there's a way that this world, where it's headed, where different skills seems to be increasingly important, maybe, and there is a world where I think those that have been maybe had to be more self-reliant and self-sufficient and would have been sort of more in poorer contexts that are not as materially dependent, maybe they have knowledge and they have teachings that people in the Western world and in the rich world and developed world, I know we're not supposed to say that, but that type of you know what I mean. So how do you see that? Is there that reversal or that, I just like to hear you thinking about on it. There's no proper question.
I really agree to that observation. And I think the movement, for those of you who are listeners here, you should really explore the Inner Development Goals movement. We are part of that movement as LM, and I'm also part of that as a leader, as a person. And that is an agenda that relates to the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, but it talks about the inner journey, what is needed, and the capabilities that are developed. I mean, it's first about being, relationship to self. So the first factor there is about inner compass, integrity, learning mindset, self-awareness, presence, and then it's about thinking. Complexity awareness, sense making, visioning. The third factor in the inner development goals is about relating, caring for others in the world. So it's about connectiveness, humility, empathy, and compassion. The fourth is about collaborating skills. So it's about co-creation, inclusive mindset, trust, mobilization skills. And the last is about acting, actually how from an inner compass, you can drive change. And then it's about courage, creativity, optimism, and also perseverance, resilience as well. And I would say this movement of the inner development goals is a way to say that we tried to create a sustainable planet and a just world by being very technical, by having indicators and measurements and budgets and interventions, projects, contributions, but we see that we actually failed because we weren't really looking at the inside, the inner compass, and what needs to be changed on the inside if we are to reach the 2030 agenda. And I would say what we need to do the remaining years, it's actually just 6 remaining years. We need to put more emphasis on the inside. And this goes for all actors in global development, the multilateral system, UN, EU, goes for government, head of states, businesses, civil society. We must really challenge leaders to be role models, to be transformational leaders. And what I'm trying in my leadership is to walk the talk. I don't want to be another leader that just give empty promises. I want to use my time to sample, to actually show how change can be possible. And I will fail at least once a month. But if I can come back and have this sort of humbleness that in our ambition and drive, we will fail. I want to be a role model to the young generation and say, don't lose your hope. We can fix this. We can fix the planet. We can actually fix or work against social injustices. And we can create a just and a sustainable world. And it's not just empty words. It's possible if we all do our job.
That's beautiful.
Sounded a bit Obama, maybe too much.
I like it. I think we need
presidential.
There's a place for preaching as well. And there's but it is what you say. I mean, it doesn't come I'm not hearing you say that from a place removed from not looking at the calamities and difficulties and the violence and all of those things that are quote unquote bad, but it's maybe, you know, you probably have a lot more contact with that than most of us. It sparks something in me. It feels calming because it's easy to get stuck in doomsday scenarios as well. And that's not helpful either. So we need to both work with what is and also have that larger connection and that spirituality or that belief that it's worth doing something. It's worth showing up. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we all should start seeing what is our potential instead of spending time looking at what frustrates us or what hinders us, because there's always going to be obstacles. And if we put our energy in analyzing those, we might lose our inspiration and courage. So I always tell young leaders and any leaders, look at your openings, your entry points, your potential, your capabilities, your unique contribution. And if you haven't found it yet, it's what you should do. You should go on a long, hike somewhere in the north of Sweden in the forests. You should get lost and you should feel, you should shiver. You should feel the minus 20 experience. And in that, you should kind of find what's your contribution to the 2030 agenda or the world. Because it might be that you're going to write poetry that will raise a whole generation. Or it might be that you will actually invent a new health tech solution for how to work more effectively with, vaccination. You might be part of the movement for the new malaria vaccine. Or it might be something very different. But you must find it. Otherwise, you have lost the potential of you having, a space on this planet at this point.
Beautiful. So if people want to support LM's work, if they want to get involved in one way or the other, financially or otherwise, where would you direct them and where can they find you?
Yeah, so if you are a Swedish citizen or a person living in Sweden or speaking the Swedish language, we have a Swedish website, läkarmissionen.se, where you can become a monthly donor, you can support our work, you can be part of our movement and engage yourself in different projects. You will also then get our magazine, where you can read impact stories from across the globe. If you are outside Sweden, you can learn more about us on our international webpage, which is lminternational.org. You can also follow me on social media. I'm on most of them, Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram. And what I do when I connect with changemakers is that I try to always make the connections. So I might direct you to our team member in Somalia, who also loves gaming, if you happen to be a gamer, or someone else. So I might not be the one you need to build deeper relationship with, but I can be a connector. So I'm often the connector. So if you engage with me on social media, I will for sure connect you further.
Lovely. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much for inviting me in.